Morning, Your Honors. Mayor Fetter for Mr. Ngo. We're now back here to address some of the...
Mislead us once again? Lead us down the garden path?
I'll do my best, Your Honor, to...
That's right. Don't worry about it. I'm used to going down that path. I'm very comfortable.
Well, we did our best to avoid having to address the questions that the court reserved in its earlier decision because of the simpler and more categorical approach that this court took the first time. But obviously the Supreme Court has made relevant all the underlying questions about what deferences do the...
We know where we are, Mr. Fetter. You're now a minute into your time. Let's get down to brass tacks.
Yeah, come on.
Let me start with the what has been referred to loosely here as the continuing violation theory. The state relies heavily on a case that we think actually supports our position, and that's the... Knox versus Davis case involving an attorney who was barred by corrections from communicating with or visiting clients. And what happened in that case is the attorney wanted to say that the initial decision barring her is not when her cause of action accrued, but rather every time she got a denial. And this court said, no, it was the decision barring her. But the key point there that I think the state overlooks, but that this court emphasized, is that she received a formal decision permanently barring her, and the court said actually, I think twice in the opinion, that it was the letter permanently suspending her and not earlier letters that she had received provisionally suspending her. That was when her cause of action accrued.
What were the restrictions that were placed on your client?
Well, my client was restricted primarily from participating in what are referred to as special programs. And the record doesn't make 100% clear at this point what the special programs were, but a lot of those involve religious observances and vocational programs and things of that nature. He was also prohibited from communicating with a particular volunteer who had worked at the prison.
Was he handed a written list of restrictions?
To the best of my knowledge, he was not. Again, the record, the complaint here doesn't indicate that he was handed anything in writing or any formal determination. I should point out that it's the defendant's burden here to show a lack of exhaustion, and there wasn't anything introduced here to show that there was
some...
Why is that? That is because of authority that we cited in our original briefing on this, where this court has held, in a case name is slipping my mind, that the burden of showing a lack of exhaustion, it's an affirmative defense. It's not something where the plaintiff has a requirement.
Was that a PLRA case?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And I apologize for not having the citation
at
hand.
We'll give you a little gum sheet. You write it down.
Thank you, Your Honor. And what you have here is a situation where we're up in a posture where the district court, based on the defense argument, ruled that there was exhaustion.
Before you go on, this is sort of important. So your position is your client comes to district court. I'm not trying to just tell me when you disagree with me. If I do, yes. If you do, just to make sure I understand the process. Your view is that your client brings a suit in district court, and he's entitled to bring the suit if they have a issue with exhaustion, they have to raise it as an affirmative defense. And they have to say this suit is barred because of exhaustion, and here is the proof that it was non-exhaustion. Is that your position?
Yes.
It is not the other way around, that your client has to come in and say, I'm bringing suit, I'm a prisoner, obviously the PLRA applies to me, and here's my proof that I've met the statutory requirements by exhausting.
Yes, Your Honor. I think in this case that...
So any absence of evidence, in your view, as to the triggering event, as to when the violation started, would fall upon defendants. Is that your position?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And I think...
When exactly is your view... And I realize you've got a continuing violation argument, which I don't want to distract you from too much, but I think we do understand what the argument is. But when, in your view, did the restriction commence?
The restriction...
What was the original triggering event?
The original triggering event, according to what was pleaded, was the deputy warden indicating apparently at some meeting in December of the year before the complaint was, or the grievance was filed, about 6 months before.
Years are important and dates are important now. We're talking 2000 now?
I believe we are. Let me just refer so that I don't...
Okay. First of all, do you remember, when he was put in the slammer?
In administrative. It was in 2000, yes.
In 2000, at some point something happens, he gets caught, or he gets apprehended doing something in the chapel or something, and...
Or at least that's what prison...
Well, something happens. I mean, they grabbed him. I mean, they
yes.
thought he was doing something wrong.
Yes.
They put him in administrative segregation.
Yes.
And 2 months later, he comes out of that.
Yes.
Okay. Do you remember what is the date when he was put in administrative segregation?
Yes. It's October 26, 2000.
October 26. So the triggering event could not have been any earlier than October 2000.
Correct.
It must have been some event subsequent to that.
Yes, I believe
and
in December.
And it could have happened while he was in administrative segregation. Now, let's say the triggering event took place while he was in administrative segregation. Do we have anything on this record to tell us whether or not he would have been able to file an appeal while he was in administrative segregation?
We don't. But... My best understanding of the record is that it was actually not while he was in administrative segregation that the restrictions were imposed.
So at some point, he gets released.
Yes.
And there is some communication at a later point in time that say, you know, we couldn't really prove it against you, but you've had a bunch of restrictions imposed. And that's a letter sent to him by the ombudsman, right?
I don't think it was a letter that was sent to him. I think
there was a letter that says that. I'm trying to piece together what we actually have. I was seeing, doesn't the letter from Kenneth Hurdle, July 9th, 2001, say that? This is at, I don't know where it is. It's in my book. Do you know what letter I'm talking about? This is a letter from the ombudsman, Kenneth Hurdle. As you know, an investigation was conducted as to inappropriate behavior between certain religious volunteers and CDC inmates. Although the original allegations were not sustained, enough information was developed to indicate that an over-familiar relationship had developed. In fact, based on a recent conversation with the warden, additional inappropriate behavior by volunteers was discovered. I personally reviewed the first investigation and agree with the findings. I will review the additional information later this week. In discussion with San Quentin staff, it was determined that some restrictions have been implemented to prevent further inappropriate behavior. So this letter, at the very least, is the end point, right? I mean, at the very latest, this he would have been notified by this time.
Would have been notified about the restrictions, Your Honor, but would not have been notified even by that necessarily that there was a permanent restriction. In other words, if there was if he had a suspension from special programs that he would not have had reason to believe that would be made permanent, and that's the difference from the case that the state is relying on. In the Knox versus Davis case, the letter that was received expressly said that there was a permanent restriction or permanent suspension, and so the decision was made then. What we have in my client's case is something that was of indefinite duration. When he wrote to the deputy warden to get it lifted, it seems to have been referred to someone else, and then no further decision was received. And so you don't have the same kind of one-time decision that triggers, you know, where the claim accrues once and for all.
And when did he actually file his grievance?
He filed his grievance in June of 2001.
Okay, so this letter comes afterwards, July 9th.
Yes.
So if this is a triggering event, you don't care, right?
Right.
Okay. Is it correct that he was never told what the scope of his restrictions were or the time limit?
Well, it
was kind of vague, wasn't it?
Yes, at least. I mean, again, this is not based on a developed evidentiary record. This is based on some fairly spare claims that are included in the record here because this was litigated in the district court just based on the notion that he hadn't gone through the last two levels of the appeals process, which, as this court noted, he wasn't able to. The state was not at the time litigating the correctness of the decision by the appeals coordinator not to accept the claims for filing. At the time, they were just saying, well, because he didn't do the further appeals, it got so. Therefore, we have this relatively undeveloped record that doesn't fully specify exactly what everyone knew at what time.
And Mr. Kane never, he just kind of left it in limbo. He never granted, never looked into it. It was just kind of forgotten and went away.
That's what appears to have happened.
How was he to know what was going on?
How is Mr. Kane to know?
Oh, your client.
Well, just the fact that, as far as he knew, he was suspended from participating in these programs.
Well, he was told he could participate in recreational programs in a memorandum dated April the 13th,
right,
2001, from the deputy warden. And then he was told in that letter that Nienhuis, the community resources manager, would review the request to participate in any other program. And if you have any additional questions, direct them to Nienhuis. But he never heard.
Right. And it was when he didn't hear from Nienhuis that he filed his grievance.
For quite a period of time.
2 months approximately.
2 months. And then he filed his grievance, and then he's told, well, your 15 days have run out.
Exactly, Your Honor.
So you're out in the cold.
Yes.
Yeah, and that's the way the case was handled.
Yes, and
we really don't have a very good record here.
No. And to the extent that we do, I mean, we don't think that this gave him a meaningful opportunity to challenge what was going on, and we also think that the determination by the appeals coordinator just not to file the thing was something that was an inappropriate application of the rules. And if that were an appropriate application,
who is this appeals coordinator? What is?
It's an official within the prison.
What training does that official have?
That is not clear from the record. There's certainly certainly the record doesn't indicate that there is anything approaching a level of training that you would normally associate with administrative officials who are authorized to make decisions the courts will defer to.
The fact is we don't know.
Right.
The record doesn't tell us, but we don't really test the credentials of IJs or ALJs either.
Well, except that there is a certain understanding that if you had things
or other federal agency officials, we don't ask the question of whether or not, when we're reviewing administrative action, whether the guy who signed the regulations really went to law school or. It's not a particularly.
At least in with the federal agency, you have something where the agency as a whole and the head of the agency is ultimately responsible for the decision. Here, you couldn't even get an appeal up to any responsible officials within the grievance system or within corrections because he just wouldn't file them. It's the equivalent of a clerk saying, this can't be filed, and so no one can appeal the decision. So you don't have the same reasons for presuming regularity.
There's no one there that can start considering whether you have a continuing violation and whether estoppel might apply and all that. They just count the days.
Yes.
You didn't raise estoppel in your brief, so you abandon that as a possibility?
Well, again, I think that the posture this came up in was one where we were not appealing a decision that rested on the notion that the appeals coordinator's decision was correct. We were appealing something that was on the basis that simply that he hadn't gone to the second and third level of appeal. This only came up as the state's alternative argument for affirming the dismissal. So there was not an occasion in the initial appeal to fully rehearse all of the theories. But I think that certainly, I don't know whether you would need to call it estoppel, but all these issues, I think, come into play in determining whether this was an available remedy under the PLRA and whether the Mr. Noh had a meaningful opportunity to avail himself of it.
He was still waiting for a decision. He was told he wanted to play baseball. They said, you can participate in recreational programs. And then for the rest of it, for those other programs, any other program, he turned it over to this resource manager, which would certainly lead him to believe that whatever the decision was, as far as his participating in programs, wasn't final. It was still a part of it.
Yes, Your
Honor. He got permission to play baseball and the recreational activities, but as far as these other programs, like going to church and going to these, I think something like anger management or something of that nature, that's still awaited a decision by the resource manager. So there was nothing final.
Right.
So when he took it on himself to interpret this 2-month delay as that, well, nobody's responding to me, and I guess that's it. And that's when he filed he took that form, those forms, and filled them out.
Yeah, nobody seems to have interpreted this initial suspension decision as kind of a one-time, forever decision until the appeals coordinator did in June when he said you had to file your grievance back then. Everyone else appeared to be treating it as something that was subject to being lifted.
In flux, yeah.
Yes.
I'm talking about clerks not filing things. I don't know how you got this past our clerk's office, but it doesn't have a certificate of compliance. You're familiar with the FAB 32 and the requirement of certificate of compliance, every brief?
Yeah, but my recollection is that only is triggered if your brief is longer than 30 pages.
Well, your recollection is poor.
Yeah.
And did you notice footnote 2 on page 20? That will appear to you to be 14-point type?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you read these briefs before you file them? Before
yes.
you sign your name to them?
I certainly do.
Okay. Now, you check on the rule, and if it's required that you file a certificate of compliance, you'll do that?
Yes.
Okay. At the very least, you need to certify that the font size complies, and if you sign a certificate, I would expect you to go through and read and make sure it does.
I'll do that, Your Honor.
All right. You got one strike against the kid.
Well, actually, probably two, but
all right,
the
two. All right.
size and the absence of the certificate.
Always good to
read. I apologize, Your Honor. What?
You'll correct the problem, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Will you nevertheless give him a minute or two for a bottle, Judge Ferguson?
Give him what?
A minute or two for a bottle.
Oh, yeah, I'm very kind today.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Judge Ferguson is always very kind.
All right.
Good morning, and may it please the Court, Deputy Attorney General Kenneth Roost for Defendant Appellees.
Did you argue the last time, too?
This is a new introduction. 178 days, Mr. No waited before filing his administrative grievance in this case.
Oh, that's if you argued.
What was the triggering event?
Well, he has admitted.
Judge Kaczynski asked you if you argued this case before.
No, this is my first time appearing in the case, Your Honor.
171 days.
Yeah. I just didn't remember. I know that Mr. Feather was here the last time. I just don't remember who was. Then
my first greeting.
Good.
And Mr. No, in this case, has admitted clear notice of the decision against him in his complaint stating that on December 22, 2000...
What decision was against him?
Decision restricting him from special programs.
Was he notified of that?
He quotes in his complaint that he was explicitly restricted by Mr. Kane from participating in any special programs.
Well, did he get a written notice?
This was an oral notice, so far as the record shows.
Is that a good way to run a prison? How many prisoners are in San Quentin?
The formality of the procedures that are required before us, we don't know.
Well,
the evidentiary record isn't developed because Mr. No did not avail himself of the administrative appeals system. However, even if you were to require...
But this is important. So you're saying he conceded actual notice... as of December?
The excerpts of record, page 10, in his own complaint, Your Honor. I'm sorry, page 3 of his own complaint, the excerpts of record, page 3. In the excerpts of record, page 10, he notes that there were confidential sources providing evidence supporting the allegations.
What are called excerpts? Is this what you're referring to?
Appellee's excerpts of record.
Appellee's excerpts of record. I don't have those. Why don't you read me what it says?
I can provide you a copy if you like.
Appellant's supplemental record? Yeah, sure. You have them handy?
I do.
Is this from the original appeal?
That's correct, Your Honor.
When he was told orally, was he told the scope of the restrictions and how long it would last?
Your Honor, that is not in the evidence before us. However,
how does he know how long it lasts?
Well, he waited 88 days before writing.
Waited 88 days to know what?
He was told that he was, quote, explicitly restricted from special programs. Until told otherwise, that a decision he could only assume would be for perpetuity until it's reconsidered. In this case, it was reconsidered. He wrote to the associate warden, Defendant Kane, 88 days after being informed of the first decision on December 22nd. And in Kane's reply, he said, yes, you can participate in recreational programs, you can play baseball, but I'm not reconsidering my decision. You can take it up with the resource manager to review the decision.
Did the resource manager ever do anything?
Mr. Noe never took it up with the resource manager, so far as we know in the evidence. Mr. Noe waited another 66 days before filing his first administrative grievance in this case.
What did the administrative guy do in the meantime?
Received no appeals, Your Honor. This is parallel, actually.
He was supposed to get back to him. He said, I've authorized community resource manager to review your request to participate in any other program.
And the letter goes on to say, if you have any questions, take them up with the resource manager. Instead, he waited 66 days before taking it up with an administrative appeals coordinator, which is the problem.
As I read that, I understood that to mean that the resource manager was going to look into this and get back to him.
Has the authority to review the decision, Your Honor, which is just like in the decision of Knox v. Davis, which Mr. Noe's counsel has pointed out. In that case, Monica Knox received clear notice that she was first barred from all visitation and correspondence privileges with her inmate clients.
He made a request to the warden, you know, on recreational activities, and I think he asked to participate in other programs, and he said, you may participate in recreational programs. But I've asked the resource manager to review your request to participate in other programs.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, well, that would mean to me, and I think it's a reasonable reading of that, that I'm going to have this guy look at it. He'll get back to you and tell you whether you can go to church.
Your Honor.
And whether you can go to these other meetings and whether you can do this or do that.
Well, decisions are made and decisions are enforced. In Monica Knox's case, her decision was looked at and reviewed, and an exception was made for her after the first notice that this court noticed. She was allowed to continue to visit with her client, Lucky, an inmate on death row.
When the warden sent him this letter, did he say see and cite to that case?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Was that case available to him in the...
In the law library?
Yeah.
Monica Knox occurred years after this instance.
Oh.
But throughout all continuing violation case law, the crux is notice, not the formality of the notice. Mr. Noe concedes notice in his complaint.
How do you know there would be a denial? What piece of paper or who told him we deny, besides the timely one?
That's, again, not in the evidence, but presumably any correctional officer would have provided the denial.
But no one did. Is that correct?
The only denial we have on the record is the letter to Associate Warden Kane, who said you can review the decision with the resources manager. The decision was never rescinded. It was in effect for the first 88 days until the writing of that letter. And for 178 days, Mr. Noe sat on his hands since December 22nd, 2000, before filing an administrative grievance.
Your argument is that it would go on forever, as long as he was in there for life, so those restrictions are there for life.
That's correct, Your Honor. Mr. Noe waited 178 days. I think in this instance, any question of timeliness is moot. He had 21 calendar days with which to submit an administrative grievance concerning a decision which was clearly delivered to him. He gives no justification for this delay. He asserts no impediments to the administrative appeals process. And he admitted the clear notice of this decision.
So your view is that he needs to be told about a particular action. He doesn't have to be told about the full scope of it or the duration. I mean, he can grieve anything, right? So it doesn't have to be a restriction. He, in this case, happens to be a restriction. But it could be administrative segregation or he could be restricted from seeing visitors, for example. Yes?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, that can happen. And so long as somebody says you've been restricted from seeing visitors, that's good enough, even if they don't tell him you've been restricted. First of all, orally is enough in your view.
Yes, Your Honor.
And second of all, there's no need to tell him of the duration or the scope of the restriction.
Actually, Your Honor, I have two responses for that. First off, he says the decision...
Doesn't know?
I think he should know of the scope. And in this case, he says he was explicitly told of the decision restricting him. He can only presume if he doesn't ask, doesn't express any ambiguity.
That's not the question I asked. That's answering a question different from the one I asked. You can do that if you want, but that's not going to give me an answer to the question I asked. Do you remember my question?
I do. Your Honor, scope is relevant in knowing whether or not you're going to have to contest a decision. However, given the evidence before us, Mr. Noe never expressed any ambiguity as to how long this would occur. He waited, probably programmed well, for 88 days and asked Mr. Cain if he would reconsider the decision.
Let me just make sure that we, just in case I get quoted again, you know, so I just want to make sure I get my question out right. Is if it is your view that notice has to include notice of the scope of the restriction?
It should, Your Honor.
That's a weasel answer.
Yes, Your Honor.
Have to require, give him notice of the scope or not?
I think depending on the impact
yes
of the decision.
No?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And you agree, and again, I don't want to put words in your mouth because I want it to be your answer, which you're bound by, that the duration of a restriction is an important part of the scope. It's not a trivial aspect of it.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. So if, for example, the facts were in this case that he was told you are restricted. I don't exactly know what language they would use, but he would be told you are restricted from special programs, and he wasn't told that this would be forever. You would agree that that notice would not be adequate?
If the notice implicitly was forever until reconsidered, I would say that he has no standing to raise it 178 days later, Your Honor.
Right, but that's not my question. Did you remember my question?
I do, Your Honor.
Okay, let me ask for an answer to my question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you remember it?
I do think that scope...
If you remember it, answer. If not, I'm happy to ask it again.
My answer is yes, Your Honor.
So, yes meaning that duration is an important, significant material aspect of the restriction of which he would need to be informed for there to be adequate notice. Yes? I mean, I'm just making sure that we agree.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Now, I've looked at the complaint here, and there's nothing here that he admits as to duration. He does seem to admit that he knew there was a restriction, and he lays out in a fair amount of detail as to what the restriction involves, but he doesn't say anything as to duration. Are we agreed on that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And and here's where you get to extemporize. Do you think this is not a problem because?
Mr. Noe never expressed any ambiguity as to duration. He never contested in his letter to the warden, the associate warden, in his letter. Mm-hmm.
I understand, but why does that matter? You have said that restriction, that duration is material.
Right.
And he was not, at least as the record shows, not told about duration. Now, maybe on remand, maybe he was told, but at least as far as this record shows, he was not told about duration. So I want you to... So I assume you're not saying, yes, we need to remand to figure out whether he was told about duration. If you are, then you say yes, and you can sit down, and then we're done as far as I'm concerned, at least. But I assume your answer is no, and I'd like to know why not.
For 2 points, Your Honor. I think the decision, in Mr. Noe's word, to be explicitly told he's denied has an error of perpetuity that until reconsidered, it would be interpreted as permanent. Mr. Noe waited his own time, 88 days, before readdressing the matter with the associate warden, and then after the response informing him that the decision was still in place, 66 days until submitting his administrative grievance. Now, he must properly proceed through the administrative grievance procedures, and without time deadlines, they become meaningless.
Well, you know, but the letter that... The memo he got from the warden on the 13th of April, that indicates, or at least indicates to me, or arguably indicates, that these restrictions were not permanent. The warden, first of all, said you can go play baseball. And then he said he tells these authorized Niehaus to review the request to participate in any other program. And that certainly implies that we're not dealing with any in perpetuity restrictions. And, you know, he's a prisoner. He's sits there and waits. He doesn't want to maybe irritate these people by, you could argue that, by asking for a decision. You've got this. Why don't you call me? Why don't you let me know? He's not going to do that. He's just going to wait. He's going to try to be a good boy, and hope that that he's restored to some of these programs that he likes to participate in.
Why isn't there a continuing violation every day? Every day he wants to do these things. Every day he can't.
Well, just as in the case of Monica Knox, Mr. Noe was hoping that his decision would be reconsidered, and Monica Knox's decision was reconsidered. An exception was made. It was in perpetuity until reconsidered, and then it was. But this Court still looked for the original letter. Ms. Knox had notice of all the wrongful acts she wished to challenge at the time of the suspension letter because it informed her that she was denied a visitation and male privileges. That's the moment of notice and accrual, which is clear in this case. And the case law for providing an exception to continuing violations is when this is vague.
What's clear in this case? Tell me again.
His statement that he was explicitly restricted by Mr. Kane from special programming.
All right.
On December 22nd, 2000, 178 days before his meeting agreement.
Mr. Kane, in a writing, can I go back and play baseball?
88 days later, Your Honor.
What?
88 days later, Your Honor. He asked.
Why is that important if it's 88 days later?
Because he'd already missed his administrative grievance deadline of 3 weeks by the time 88 days had passed. And even if we say that this reconsidered or retriggered.
So he communicates with Kane and he says, can I play baseball? And Kane says, yeah, go ahead. Play baseball and Niehaus is going to review these other requests of yours.
I think it's important also to distinguish, to note in the letter, Mr. Noe distinguished recreational programs from the special programs he was barred from.
What's
the difference? Can I play baseball, and is the ban on special programs, can you lift it?
What's the difference? What's recreational? What's the other?
Baseball is recreational. The special programs were the special religious programs he was denied of because of his alleged sexual misconduct with a state volunteer at the Catholic chapel.
They decided there was nothing to that, right? They couldn't prove it.
They had confidential sources providing evidence, nothing provable, but enough. In a prison, they must enforce their safety and security, and BART restricting Mr. Noe from special programs that he has abused is a sensible and within their jurisdiction thing to do. And as to why this isn't a continuing violation, Mr. Noe's counsel himself points to Pace Industries, a case in antitrust, which states that statute of limitations is only restarted by separate violations within the limitations period that are not controlled by the previous act or decision. The key here.
So we're now in antitrust law, huh?
That was an analogy that Mr. Noe's counsel brought up for the point of continuing violations when they apply. It's when they're separate independent decisions, but reinforcing a single decision, which was never adjusted, never changed in Mr. Noe's case.
Would you say the state officials in part contributed to the problem by having rules that are so vague no one can understand them, and also sending that report on April 21st saying, we'll get back to you?
Well, Your Honor, Title 15 is published and given to every inmate, and it's very clear as the rules and procedures that must be followed.
I'm asking about the officials carrying out the rules. You got the rules, but in the way they carried them out, particularly that letter, I think it's April 21st, where he said, we'll get back to you. Doesn't that kind of, the state kind of participated in causing whatever this problem is?
Actually, that's easily distinguishable, Your Honor. The proper procedural administrative procedure for submitting an administrative appeal is on a Form 602 to the appeals coordinator. You don't informally write to the associate warden. It's surprising you got a response at all in this case. He had 15 working days, 3 weeks, to submit an administrative grievance to the appeals coordinator on a Form 602.
Why did Mr. Cain write and say, I'll have my coordinator get back to you? What was the point of that?
He allowed Mr. Noe to take the decision directly up with the resources manager if he wanted to reconsider a decision.
And the resource manager didn't do anything.
He didn't change the decision, Your Honor.
So didn't the resource manager in some way contribute to the problem we have here today?
If the problem was Mr. Noe's continued denial of access to special programs.
Didn't he in some part contribute to the problem we have today?
I think the problem of any vagary on the record is entirely on the shoulders of Mr. Noe because he didn't create an evidentiary record by pursuing the proper procedural grievance that was available.
Vagary? Do you know what that term means?
It means different things in different circumstances, Your Honor. But when we're talking about...
It actually has an English meaning, you know. It has nothing to do with vagueness.
Right.
But go ahead.
Well,
so, are you done answering this?
Don't ever use that word again.
Noted.
Perpetuity.
At least not in that way. So let's say we wind up disagreeing with you and we think that there was... insufficient notice here, or that continued violation, and in any event that the appeals council was wrong, or whatever the appeals board was wrong in dismissing the appeal as untimely. What follows from that? What would follow from that?
Well, at that point, you would actually address the degree of deference that you'd extend to the administrative appeal coordinator's decision that this was an untimely grievance, which throughout all of the...
Let's say we found that against you as well. And we said we don't give them any deference, we give them plenty of deference, but despite the deference, they were wrong. Okay, so let's say we're at that point in the process.
Okay.
What follows after that?
Then the case would be remanded to the district court, Your Honor, for further evidentiary and motions.
But what is the consequence of a finding that the appeals process that he filed a proper grievance, a timely grievance, and wasn't considered? Does the case then get sent back to the prison for them to consider the grievance, or does the case then proceed in district court on the merits of the 1983 claim?
Actually, in the instance of a motion dismissed based on exhaustion, it's dismissed without prejudice, so the inmate can then go back and properly exhaust the complaint, which in this case would seem to
occur. I don't think you understood my question. Let's say you lose on all that. We say he did exhaust because the appeals counsel was wrong in its determination. Does the district court then proceed to consider the merits of the 1983 claim? Or is there some obligation to send it back to the prison authorities to consider the grievance as having been timely filed?
Well, 2 points, Your Honor. If you found that the administrative...
I give you an either or choice.
Sure.
Is either of those choices acceptable, or do you have some other possibility? I thought I had exhausted the universe of possibilities with those two choices, and that one or the other ought to be acceptable, but maybe I'm wrong. Is there some other possibility I haven't thought about?
If exhaustion...
You can go forward with the case in district court, or you can send it back for them to consider the grievance. You think that pretty much exhausts possibilities?
That seems to be the world of possibilities.
So you don't have a third possibility?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Do you think one of those is right and one of those is wrong?
I think the case would be sent to the appeals coordinators to properly exhaust the complaint if it had standing at that point.
Okay, so at that point, the remedy would be send it back. Do the district courts have authority to send things back, to remand things back to administrative boards of prisons?
Well, normally...
Or, you know, the alternative is to say, well, you know, the state got a chance to consider the grievance. It was timely. They were wrong. Too bad. We proceed in district court with considering the merits of the claim. That's another possibility, right?
Well, Your Honor, in answer to the question, if there were a mistake and it were deemed properly exhausted, the district court would then directly address the case. But if it were deemed not properly exhausted, it would be sent back to the prisons for proper exhaustion to follow. In this case, There was not proper exhaustion. He never took it up the four tiers of the appeals that California holds out in its corrections departments.
Well, you agree that if he filed a timely grievance, if we determine he filed a timely grievance and they were just wrong in saying it's untimely, put your mind to that possibility.
Then the district court would address it on the issues.
On the merits?
Correct, Your Honor.
It wouldn't get sent back?
No.
Okay, that's what I don't know. Okay.
Any further questions?
You have First Amendment claims involved here.
Yes, Your Honor.
Do you know why a prisoner only gets 15 days to file a grievance?
The Supreme Court noted the U.S. amicus brief in this issue that departments of corrections afford between 2 to 4 weeks. California affords 3 weeks. And they didn't express any umbrage with these deadlines. In fact, they expressed the distinction between filing in federal court, the relative ease of filing an administrative grievance. You point out the problem and the action requested, like ordering dinner. I'm hungry, I'd like the filet mignon. And the menus that you would...
I'm hungry, I'd like what?
The filet mignon, Your Honor.
Taking an order. What? I'm hungry and I'd like what?
The filet mignon. You might prefer the fish, Your Honor.
Oh, filet mignon.
In Mr. Noh's case...
I think you want to get filet mignon on death row, and then in only limited circumstances.
Truly.
But nobody wants filet mignon anymore.
I do occasionally order it, Your Honor.
Thanks to naughty death.
Everything else, yeah. When should he have filed that
It would be on...
When should you file that Form 602?
He was informed of the clear decision restricting him on December 22, 2000. In his case, 15 working days worked out to 25 calendar days.
He was informed something on that date, no doubt about it. Let's say he's just not sure. He says, look, they told me there's some sort of restriction. I'd like to look at my file. Or I'd like... Is there some way he can figure out what exactly it is that was...
Absolutely, Your Honor. If he was alleging improper procedure on behalf of prison officials, that is precisely what the administrative grievance process is here to address, to fill out the evidence, to try to resolve it before it ever gets to court.
No, but let's say he doesn't know whether it's improper, or he doesn't even know what exactly the scope of restriction is. You know, somebody walks up to him and says, you've been restricted for special programs. If you've got a Social Security decision, any kind of administrative decision, usually an immigration case, you usually get a piece of paper that tells you, here's what's been done to you, and here are your rights. Now, let's put aside the here are your rights part. Somebody walks up to him and says something. Is there some way in which he can figure out what that something is? How does he know whether he's even got a complaint?
If Mr. Noh were ambiguous, he would then ask the official, well, what do you mean by something? And if he didn't get a reasonable response, he would file an administrative grievance. What something? What's happening?
He can't look at his file, right?
Excuse me?
He can't demand to see his file.
They are actually allowed to see their non-confidential C files, absolutely.
And let's say he made a demand to see the non-confidential C file. Would this restriction be in there?
I don't know, Your Honor.
I'm sorry.
The evidence has not been developed in this case. I don't know.
Kind of thing. This is the first time I hear that there's a confidential and non-confidential C file. I don't even know what the C file is. But... what kind of things are in the non-confidential C file? Would this kind of thing be in the non-confidential C file?
I believe so, but I cannot speak affirmatively that this specific decision was.
Anyway, so if a prisoner wants to see his non-confidential C file, as you call it, what does he do?
He would ask his correctional counselor to review it, and he would be provided it.
They would provide him access to it?
Correct, he would.
His counselor is who?
I don't know who Mr. Noh's correctional counselor was.
Is it this guy that wrote the... I'm still trying to figure out who the guy is that wrote the letter on July 9th.
That was Defendant Kane. He was the associate warden at San Quentin.
No, I'm talking about
July 9th letter was signed by Kenneth Hurdle, ombudsman. Who's he?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Huh. And what function did he have in this process?
I don't know, Your Honor. I haven't seen the letter you're discussing.
It's in the file. July 9th letter? I don't think I just made it up.
I don't think you made it up either, but it's not in the files I've reviewed.
I'm pretty sure I saw it anyway.
Actually, could you repeat the name of the...
Hurdle. H-U-R-D-L-E.
Hurdle.
What was the date of the letter, Your Honor?
July 9th. I don't think I have this from a different case. Do you know anything about it?
I don't, Your Honor. If you'd like me to review the letter...
Let me ask you this. Restrictions, it's not uncommon for restrictions to be placed on inmates, is it?
No, Your Honor.
Now, what's the process that's followed in doing that?
For an administrative segregation or a similar procedure, Hewitt, by the Supreme Court, establishes the degree of...
You know, like in this case here, what would be the normal procedure?
You would have notice of the charges and an opportunity to be heard by the critical decision maker, which in this instance was Mr. Kane giving him the decision. And all this was here, and the decision by the prison just needs to be supported by some evidence.
What were the charges? I still don't know what they were.
Sexual misconduct with a state volunteer at the prison chapel.
Those are the charges? Are those the charges why he's getting the restrictions?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
The only ones?
Correct, Your Honor.
The ones that they can't prove, but they have in a secret file, maybe they can.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Well, okay. Normally, with a inmate where restrictions are placed on them, is something put in the file where the assistant warden would say, well, these restrictions were imposed on this inmate, and they put it in the file?
I would expect that to be the case, but I cannot give an affirmative answer as to what happened in this case.
Is it the general practice there to just communicate these restrictions to an inmate verbally? Not in writing?
Any moves into administrative segregation and follow-up meetings would be recorded and kept in the C file, Your Honor.
Do you have this thing called excerpts filed on August 13th, 2004?
Is this appellant's or appellee's excerpts from the record, Your Honor?
Well, it must be appellant's because I would have hoped that the state didn't prepare anything like this.
I actually reviewed every page of both, Your Honor.
Well, then you didn't find Kenneth Hurdle's. You should have found Kenneth Hurdle's letter because it's marked as Exhibit B in this thing called excerpts. See, I can now give you something. Don't you come
I appreciate that, Your Honor.
We can sort of... I'm not afraid. You can come here. You're not carrying a gun on you, are you?
We've got...
You can have this back, too. This is yours.
You want me to keep it if you like,
Your Honor. Well, I'm sure we have copies. You got that thing that I just gave you? Did it be? The Kenneth Hurdle letter?
These are attachments to the appellant's brief before this court the previous time it was heard. Exhibit B attached to appellant's informal brief?
I guess so.
I guess this was the informal brief submitted by Mr. No on the previous appeal.
Do you have a seat?
No, Your Honor. But I'm happy to respond to it.
Okay. That's even better.
This seems to be confirmation from a San Quentin official as to the affirmation of the charges against Mr. Ngo for his sexual misconduct and enforcing the decision to restrict him from special programs. I'm not sure what an ombudsman is, but it sounds important, Your Honor.
Well, is this a step in the administrative process?
This is not a step held out by Title 15s for the formal appeals procedure, no, Your Honor, unless this was a consequence of the appeals process, but since it never went forward, it couldn't be.
Okay, so you can't shed any more light on this than it says on its own face, huh?
Unfortunately, no, Your Honor.
What does it say? Just to refresh our recollection.
This is in response to your letter to this office concerning your programming. Specifically, you are alleging that you are being denied access to religious programs. As you know, an investigation was conducted as to inappropriate behavior between certain religious volunteers and CDC inmates. Although the original allegations were not sustained, enough information was developed to indicate an over-familiar relationship had developed. In fact, based on recent conversation with the warden, additional inappropriate behavior by volunteers was discovered. I have personally reviewed the investigation and agree with the findings. I will review additional information later this week. In discussion with San Quentin staff, it was determined that some restrictions have been implemented to prevent further inappropriate behavior. I am recommending that you once again discuss this issue with the warden or chief deputy warden, that's Defendant Kane, for a clarification of the restrictions. This now brings closure to our involvement in this issue.
Does what?
It brings closure to our involvement in the issue. This was an ongoing investigation into the charges of sexual misconduct.
Who is our involvement?
Excuse me, Your Honor?
I'm a little hazy on this, the bringing closure to our involvement in the issue.
I believe
it sounds to me like there was some process going on here of which Kenneth Hurdle was, of this letter was sort of the termination of our process. It sounds from this letter like Hurdle had been asked to look into this, and he reviewed evidence. He says he's going to review additional evidence later in the week, and after some discussion, he decided this is okay, and he's not involved anymore. So it's just some sort of ongoing process.
My guess is, would this be with the ongoing investigation for disciplinary charges against the inmates to see what further steps might be done? In this case, he just reaffirmed Defendant Kane's original bar from special services.
Now, the prisoner is no longer at SQ, right?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
The case is not moot because he's seeking damages?
Actually, one of the arguments for the district court was that this case was moot, but they never reached that decision.
I know there's that. I'm just wondering why this wasn't pressed here or is not being pressed now. The mootness, after all, is trumps all else. It's like death.
Well, to the extent that a mootness argument isn't waived, I suppose I would raise a mootness argument.
You can't waive mootness. Are you kidding?
I thought the district court would address mootness if this were remanded for further
How
proceedings.
How could you possibly waive mootness?
Well, for argument before this court.
How could you waive mootness? Never waived. It's a jurisdictional question. So is your position that the case is moot?
I don't have enough evidence to assert that position right now. If Your Honors would like additional briefing on the issue.
He's not at SQ right now.
I don't think he is.
And do we know whether the restriction applies has followed him to wherever he is now?
I don't think it would have, Your Honor.
It would be a good idea just to remand this all back to the district court and make findings in all these questions we have?
I would think that's not necessary, given the 178 delay in affording himself at the administrative appeals process.
Your answer is it's not a good idea.
If you think that Mr. No did attempt to properly exhaust his grievance, then my answer is yes.
Not clear to me. When does this grievance procedure begin? With the filing of an informal grievance?
That's correct. You fill out the form 602 and you write down.
That's not informal, is it?
It's called informal, Your Honor.
It's called informal.
That's the moniker associated with it. You would hand the 602 to an official who would review your description of a problem and requested action. If you have difficulty writing in English, someone would help you fill out the form 602. Every opportunity is afforded the inmates to get to the administrative grievance process.
Oh, and goes letter to the deputy warden. That's the informal phase.
No, Your Honor, that's not a form 602. That is correspondence personally between Mr. No and Defendant Kane.
Well, how do you define formal and informal?
By Title 15, Your Honor. It supplies the names and stages of each grievance proceeding that it affords.
So who was Title 15?
That's Section 3084, the entirety of that section in Title 15, supplies all the appeals procedures.
So how does it define informal?
You fill out the Form 602, you describe a problem and the action you want taken to resolve it. Someone reviews it.
So that's informal. What's the formal?
If you don't like what was done at the first stage, you would submit it for further investigation. It would go to the warden. And if the warden rejected it, then it would go to the Office of Administrative Appeals for a final decision at the fourth level.
So it depends on the heading of the form. Is that it?
It's the same form, Your Honor. It's just you proceed to fill out different parts of the form for each rejection or if you're not satisfied at each stage.
All right. You're having a good time here today?
I hope we all are, Your Honor.
Good. Well, I appreciate your help.
I appreciate your time.
Not an easy case.
No, Your Honor.
Yeah, it's not an easy case. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. My ear better. You're going to shed some light.
All I wanted to add, Your Honor, is that on mootness, there is a damages claim that would prevent it from being moot. And I also think that there have been times since being transferred from San Quentin that Mr. No has then been housed again in San Quentin and restrictions have applied. But that...
What happened again?
I believe that he was transferred out of San Quentin, but then... for various reasons, there have been periods when he has again been housed at San Quentin, so that the restrictions can be applied to him when he is. I think he had possibly a court date in the San Francisco area and was transferred for that reason. So I don't think that they're being applied in his current place of incarceration, but they do apply when he is back at San Quentin. But again, this is not based on something in the record. This is based on my understanding from just from speaking to Mr. No subsequently. But in any event, I would think that the damages claim alone is enough to preclude any finding of mootness. Other than that, I don't have anything to add. But
what did he do with the admission in his complaint that he was aware of the restriction as of a day after it was imposed? This is the document that the opposing counsel showed me.
I think the critical point is that he was not given this was not imposed for all that appears as a permanent restriction. And in the absence of that, where it's something that appears to have been imposed in a relatively informal way without a written finding, and not, and there's no indication he was told it was permanent, then it is something that is at best indefinite to continue for some time, and it's not and to be reconsidered. It's not a one-time decision, as in the case that the defense relies on, where this court specifically said in a couple of places that the cause of action accrued when the letter was sent saying that it was a permanent and complete suspension of the attorney's rights. Prior letters had been sent in that case that were sort of interim suspensions. That was not when the court said that the cause of action accrued. It was only when there was a permanent decision made. Here, you don't have that, and so it's not a one-time decision extending throughout his life term.
But that's slicing the salami pretty thin. There is a restriction placed on him. He knows there's a restriction placed on him. If he wants to find out more, he can find out more about the scope of the restriction. I mean, are you saying even the restriction, I mean, let's say if he looked in the file, the restriction would say he's permanently for life barred from these special activities. I mean, so the restriction itself as entered is in fact permanent. But he's not told about the permanence. He's just said, let's say, we've restricted you. They don't say it's temporary. They don't say how long it is. They don't say it's permanent. They just don't say. Is your position that he can, at that point, he can sort of treat it as not being permanent and he doesn't have to inquire?
Yes, Your Honor. That is our position. I think that if he's, but certainly, I don't think.
What are you arguing for? Are you arguing for that the inmates need to get a written notice every time there was a restriction placed or some sort of discipline? Do they need to get it in the writing?
Well, frankly, Your Honor, if you're talking about something that is going to last for the duration of a life sentence and is such a broad restriction as this one, that's something that probably ought to be in writing. But even if there's not going to be a requirement that it be in writing, there at least would have to be something giving him notice that this is not how he's currently being classified, but rather that this is a permanent lifetime restriction based, I should add, on a situation where there isn't even a finding against.
But what standard am I applying? I thought, looking at the Supreme Court's opinion, no, what they said is he has to have some reasonably fair notice as to what the restriction is. And why isn't it enough that they said, look, there's a restriction? And he's quite specific about the restriction is. He says, I can't do this. He has a long list of things he can't do. So he knows exactly what the restriction prohibits. The one thing I guess is not clear was whether he knows that this is permanent or it's temporary or it's there until they feel like changing it. Why isn't it the kind of thing we say, look, you've got to know that something like that has happened to you. If you want to know more, you got to ask about it. You got to ask for clarification. You got to go look at your file. And if not, if you're not sure, you got to grieve it right there and then, or else you're out of luck.
Essentially, well, first of all, there's no indication that if he had looked at his file, he would have seen something that said permanent restriction. But even aside from that, for that matter, we don't know even that he didn't look at his file, although let's assume that he didn't. The Supreme Court doesn't say anything about how this is supposed to be applied. All the Supreme Court says is that Congress is creating this rule, and the rule has to have teeth of essentially a procedural default sanction. But particularly when you're adding that kind of sanction to it, if you're going to say that in all instances where it's not clear what the scope is in terms of the length of time of the restriction, the prisoner has to essentially prophylactically file a grievance so that if it does turn out to be something that lasts permanently, that he can preserve his claim, all you're doing then is encouraging what will probably be unnecessary use of process, of triggering formal process in a lot of cases.
Isn't that the state's problem? If they want to have extra paper and extra, then that's their problem. That's just, they can make a different procedure. I'm happy with that. It doesn't cost the prison anything. There's no filing fee. You get a free form. They even, provide a translator if you can't speak English. If you can't write, they get something to write it for you. So what's the big deal? Is he busy going to his job or something? I mean, he's got nothing else to do. What's the problem with having him file a piece of paper saying, look, there's a restriction. I've been told there's a restriction. It's a very serious restriction. I know that it prohibits me from doing all these things that will keep me from going on probation. And I can't find out whether it is, how long it lasts, and I'll agree with it. And maybe in the grievance process they'll say, well, it's only there for 6 months.
Well, first of all, there's nothing here indicating that maybe this is permanent, maybe not, and it's something that he can't find out. All the indications here, if anything, is that it was something that was a measure taken at the time that was going to be subject to reconsideration. But you're also, one reason for the prisoner not doing it is, if you assume a prisoner who doesn't want to be a troublemaker and wants to essentially take his medicine and say, I'll accept the restriction and at the appropriate time it'll be reconsidered and I'll deal with it that way, you're essentially forcing him into a situation of confrontation with prison officials, which there is going to be a disincentive for a lot of prisoners to put themselves in that situation. And you also have a situation where there is nothing indicating to the prisoner in advance that the prison is going to interpret the rules this way so that he loses all ability to even file a grievance or his federal lawsuit based on the fact that in response to this unwritten notice to him that he was going to be restricted when he got out of administrative segregation, that they're going to say, if you didn't do it right then you're forever barred from doing it. So
let me ask you this question. What would you like us to do for you?
Well, I think that that the appropriate thing would be a determination that the prison grievance coordinator was not correct in rejecting this. And in the cases where the prison has one way or another inappropriately failed to make the grievance system available, it doesn't get then remanded for the grievance to go back. The case proceeds in the district court, and I think that is what we're asking for here.
Well, when would the 15-day period start to run, in your view?
The 15-day period would start to run here. Again, we think it's ongoing, but I would say if there had been a...
Forget about the ongoing. When do you think?
I think that if he had gotten a final determination from when he wrote to the warden, and the warden wrote back saying that this other official has authority to address this, had he gotten a decision from that other official, then you can have the 15-day period start to run then. Here, because he didn't get a response, I don't think the 15-day period really started to run because he didn't get any ruling on his request to lift the restrictions.
Do you think based on this record we can do what you want, or should it go back to the district court to make findings of all these questions that we've been discussing for the last hour?
I think that based on the record, the court could do what we're asking for, but that certainly if the court is not prepared to do that, that the appropriate thing would be to remand to develop a record on all these questions.
Well, what's the record that supports your preferred view? When did the 15 days start to run?
Well, I think the record is what you have here with the letter to the warden, to the deputy warden.
Tell me when it started to run.
Well, I think that for that it essentially did not start to run because he didn't get a final decision on his request to lift the restrictions.
So it never started to run. Never started to run here.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's right.
Still open. I mean, that event, when the 15 days starts, that has not occurred yet.
Yes, Your Honor.
So why is that?
Because this is something, I mean, I think that to the extent that there is a complaint about the original period of time until the letter to the deputy warden, then the time ran on that. But once he filed a request with the deputy warden to have the restrictions lifted, then on his complaint about those restrictions being imposed on him on a continuing basis from that point on, I don't think the time has run on that period of time.
Because that other aspect was being considered by this other person.
Yeah, because he did grieve about it, essentially. He filed an informal request, or what the prison appears to have treated as an informal request, and never got an answer.
So it still hasn't run.
Right. I don't think he can say, now I shouldn't have been restricted on December 27th and December 28th and December 29th, when he was willing to accept that at the time without filing a grievance. But once he does file the grievance for the continuing decision to restrict him, or does file with the deputy warden, then I don't think his time starts to run on that until he actually gets a decision on it, which he didn't get.
Okay. All right. Any other questions?
I don't understand why you think that. I mean, there's this grievance process, right? What does this inquiry to the deputy warden have to do with starting the time to run for purposes of the grievance process?
Because what it would be the this would be essentially his complaint or his request to have this ongoing decision to restrict him stop, that it was no longer justified to the extent that it was ever justified. And there is a decision that's being made on an ongoing basis to continue the restrictions. So his calling it to the attention of prison officials and essentially starting the machinery in motion is what that has to do with the grievance process. He is complaining about the decision to continue the restrictions.
I'm a little baffled by that. I'm just not following at all. I mean, somebody gets thrown in prison, there's a trial, there's a sentence, there's an imposition of sentence, right? And let's say he's given a 20-year sentence. Can he sort of ever, and he forgets to appeal. Can he then sort of try to say, well, you know, I didn't know the sentence was going to be there for 20 years. I asked, he writes a letter to the district judge asking to register his sentence. Does that sort of start a new appeals process?
Well, he can, because it's a 20-year term.
If it's permanent, into something that's maybe temporary by asking for reconsideration.
Because it wasn't permanent. In your example, he's sentenced to 20 years.
Restriction. By its terms, it doesn't say it's a restriction that's going to end tomorrow or in 6 months or in 3 months or in 6 years. It just says, this prisoner no longer have these rights. Bam, that's it. What more does it need to say?
But I don't think that it's a decision that this prisoner no longer has these rights. This prisoner is given a restriction, and what more there is to be said is you're permanently restricted. It's one thing to take a disciplinary measure and say you're going to be restricted, but based on the way things are now, I mean, particularly since this was not a sanction based on a finding, this is not a penalty imposed now.
It doesn't matter what it's based on. They can do it. They don't need to have a violation. And if he doesn't like it, if he doesn't think it's justified, he can grieve it. That's what the grievance process is about. Say, look, you imposed this thing. You didn't even find me in flagrante delicto. You know, whatever you think I was doing with that priest, it wasn't it. That's what grievance is for.
I think it does depend what it's based on, because if something is being imposed as a penalty for particular conduct that has occurred, then that's been found to have occurred, then maybe the defense would have more of an argument that this, because it's a penalty, it's a one-time thing that's imposed for something that happened in the past. But if the justification is that for purposes of making sure that things are, that inappropriate conduct doesn't take place in the prison, we're going to put somebody on a restricted basis because of our assessment that this person is a danger of engaging in that conduct, that's something that by its nature is not a one-time decision that he's a danger for the rest of his life. That's something that is based, that lasts only as long as that determination is in place about whether he's a risk. Now, I'm not saying this is determinative, but I think that it definitely does figure into whether the reasonable understanding of the restriction is that it's going to be permanent or that it's something that we're doing for now. And I think that to the extent that this is going to turn on whether the reasonable understanding of what restriction was imposed is that it was a permanent restriction, I think that's something that would require remand to the district court to address all of the circumstances about what exactly he was told, what he was told about it, what the setting was, and so forth. I don't think that's necessary because I think that under these circumstances, if he's just told you're restricted without any notice that it's permanent, that's enough to take it outside the class of cases where you're saying there's a one-time thing that has to be appealed right then. But certainly if you're going to get into what's...
What would the rule of law be that would come out of your position?
I think the rule of law would be...
What would the holding be?
The holding would be that if you have something that is imposed as a sanction of a definite scope for a definite term, then you have to file the grievance within the time limit running right then. But that if you have something that is not done for a definite term, but rather someone is put in a restricted classification of some sort, that in the absence of something demonstrating that this is a decision now and forever, if the understanding is it's something that is open to reconsideration on an ongoing basis, not merely by reference back to the original decision. And so there's an ongoing decision to restrict the person, and the time for challenging that runs from the time of each ongoing decision.
All right. Anything further? Any further?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. matter will stand submitted. We thank both sides for an enlightened argument. And we'll now adjourn. All right.